All right, we're going to talk about Genesis today. We're going to be in Genesis 20 and probably get to 24 is my guess. We'll see how far we get. But Genesis 20 starts with this story where to that triplet of that narrative about she is my sister. So we've had it again with in the Yahwist account in Genesis 12. Where Pharaoh says, hey, I want to take her. And Abraham's like, hey, she's my sister. And this is going to be the text from the Elohist. This is the northern text. And the Elohist text comes from the north. In this instance, this is the first appearance of the Elohist in the Old Testament. This is the first record we have, like I said earlier in one of our meetings, that the Elohist is the least given or the least represented of this different strains of the Pentateuch. And this is his first introduction in the narrative. And so here we have Abraham's journeying thence, it says, towards the south country, and he sojourned in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. And this time it's not the Pharaoh, but it's Abimelech. It says Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. And then the rest of the narrative is so similar to the Genesis 12 account. We read another account later in the 26th chapter. In the 26th chapter, it's going to be Isaac and Rebekah. We got kind of the same issue going on, like she's my sister. And so if you read carefully the 20th chapter, it's very similar to the 12th. So in verse 9, Abimelech calls and says, what have you done to me? So Abimelech puts the onus on Abraham, and he's like, look what you've done. You've messed with me, and notice what it says. It's this sterility stuff going on. Like, look in verse 18. For the Lord had fast closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. If you listen to the podcast we did on Genesis 12, you see this is like the repeated narrative. The people are cursed because of this. And, you know, finally Abraham's like, okay, I'm gonna tell you what's up. But then we get this really interesting spin. This is different than the Yahwist account. In this account, in Genesis 20, Abraham does say, hey, well, actually, she is my sister. Look what he says in verse 12. He says, yet indeed, she is my sister. So he kind of defends himself. He says, she's the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And so in the show notes and in the slides, which are, you know, both on Canvas and on the website, the very first slide after you get past the intro is the She is My Sister slide, and I actually give you the breakdown of Abraham and his family. And Sarah is the daughter of Terah, which is Abraham's father. So verse 12 of chapter 20 is correct. She is his sister in the sense that they both have the same father. And this is, you know, really troubling to some people as they read the Bible. It's not really, it shouldn't be troubling to you by this point as you realize that, hey, the Bible has many different strains. There's lots of stuff going on here in the text. But if you're looking for the Bible to be like one complete unified whole, and it's all been authored by one guy, this is one of those evidences that there's probably some strains happening here because of some different passages. So you're going to need to look at Leviticus 18 briefly to see what I'm talking about. Now, Leviticus 18 is in scholarship considered to be written by the priestly author. And a lot of this stuff is textualized right before and right after the exile, 586 BC. And Leviticus 18 is a laundry list of the Lord telling Moses, hey, don't do the stuff that your enemies are doing. Don't be like these guys. And it's just it's a who's who list of all the negative things that their enemies are doing. And it's very explicit. Well, one of the things that the Lord says in Leviticus 18 is verse 11. It says, the nakedness of thy father's wife's daughter, begotten of thy father, she is thy sister, thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. The phrase uncover her nakedness or his nakedness is a euphemism for having relations. And so Leviticus 18 verse 11 clearly prohibits a man being married to a woman who is from his father, even if it's a different wife, which is clearly against what Abraham's doing here. Now, I don't have a problem with this. Now, here's my way out, my explaining this. Abraham predates the Levitical law. He predates Moses. And I don't necessarily think that Genesis 20 and Leviticus 18 have the same author. It's, to me, pretty clear that they don't. And so the priestly author is redacting and writing legislation and those kinds of things much longer after Abraham's around. So this problematic issue is just kind of fixed when you look at it that way. if we see the Bible as a collection of books that were written over many centuries, and as these books were assembled and redacted and rewritten and textualized, these kind of contradictions don't seem to trouble me and most of the students that read the text. But it's just good to see that this is happening. In fact, that's really where the word text comes from. It comes from the Latin word textus, which means that which is woven together. And so I really do see, we're going to talk about this today a little bit, about what's called the documentary hypothesis, the nature of the text of the Bible, that it's strains that are woven together, hence the meaning of the word text. Now, to start, I will say Mormon tells us that he's doing this. When Mormon's putting together the Book of Mormon, he says, look, I've got all these records, and I'm just going to put them together at kind of as I see fit. At one point, he takes what he calls the small plates of Nephi, and without any editorial stuff, he just puts those in there. And throughout the Book of Mormon, he'll tell a story, and then he'll do what's called prophetic midrash. He'll say things like, and thus we see, and then he'll give commentary that's inspired to tell you why he's taking those stories in there and putting them in. And that's called redaction. That's called editing. And that's really who Mormon is. He's a redactor. He's an editor. He's an abridger. And he's showing you that he's doing this. What I want to propose to you guys is that that's really what's happening in the Old Testament. But the editor, or editors as it were, they're not showing you their hand. And so they have tells. They have things that they show that they don't mean to show. Like a tell is something like if you're playing poker with somebody and they rub their face when they don't have a card or whatever. That's a tell. The editors have these tells, and they have what I call breadcrumbs that they're throwing all over the place, whether on purpose or not. But they don't come right out and say, hey, and thus we see I, Mormon, wrote this record. Let me explain this to you. They're just kind of giving you the narrative. Anyway, so back to Genesis 20. So he gets her back. He gets his wife back, similar to Genesis 12. Abimelech gives her, and by the way, Abimelech is just two words combined together. It's Ab and Melech. It's father and king. So father, king, this king of Gerar, gives her back. And then he also gives money. Look what it says in verse 16 of chapter 20. It says, unto Sarah, he said, behold, I have given thy brother 1,000 pieces of silver. So he calls Abraham her brother. Behold, he is to thee a covering of thy eyes unto all that are with thee and with all others. Thus she was reproved. So Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bare children. So verse 17, it is all put back together. And then we get, Sarah back. So this is, like I said, Genesis 12 all over again. And then we get to chapter 21. So I like to look at chapter 20 as another instance of Sarah being tested. 21, she's going to bear Isaac. And so this totally defies reason, because look what it says. Well, first, before we even look at verse 1 of chapter 21, I mean, look back at Genesis 17. Genesis 17:17 says, Abraham fell on his face and laughed, Sahach, and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100, and shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear? So she's 90 in this chapter, and she's 127 when she passes away. She's buried in the cave of Machpelah, and that's in chapter 23. Chapter 23 tells you in verse 1 that she lived to be 127 years old. Now, the Yahwist is going to say nobody lives past 120. And so in scholarship, they're going to say that the 23rd chapter is going to be written by the priestly author. None of that really probably matters to you. But she's 127. So she's somewhere in this range of 90 to 127 when she has Isaac. She's really old. And so if you get to the 21st chapter where she has Isaac, it says, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. And Sarah conceived and bare Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken. This really does defy reason. And it reminds us of so many cool stories. One of my favorites is going to be right out of the New Testament. Right out of the New Testament, when we read verse 34 of chapter 1, Mary said to the angel, how shall this be, seeing I know not a man? So the angel tells her, you're going to have a child. And she's like, I'm not married. And the angel said, the Holy Ghost shall come upon thee, and the power of the highest shall overshadow thee. Therefore also that holy thing which shall be born of thee shall be called the Son of God. And behold, thy cousin Elizabeth, she also has conceived a son in her old age, and this is the sixth month with her, who was called barren. And then verse 37, for with God nothing shall be impossible. And I just want to testify of that. I believe in a God who can do hard things. who can do things that to you and me may seem impossible. And so this text of Genesis, Genesis 21, is one of the ways that God is expressing to us that even in the midst of great difficulty, he can do his work. Now, we've seen it throughout the narrative. We've seen it as Sarah has been tested twice now in the idea of being taken by the king. We've seen it in so many ways. But today we're going to see it even more graphically illustrated in the command for Isaac to be sacrificed. But it starts here with her in her old age, and with God, nothing shall be impossible. So I would just encourage you to highlight Luke 1:37. And it says in chapter 21 of Genesis, Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, and Sarah bare him, and they called him Isaac, Yitzhak. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. In verse 6, Sarah said, God has made me to laugh, sahach, so that all that hear will laugh with me. So there's punning going on here in the text. And so we have Isaac, and he's rejoicing, and it means to laugh. And you can see that there in the footnote, chapter 21, verse 6. The root means both to laugh and to rejoice. And so now we get to the story, and this is really difficult. This is the 21st chapter we're still in. And this is the story of Hagar and Ishmael. And this is really tough. So we're going to read it, and we're going to try to unpack some of this. So verse 9, it's going to say, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had born unto Abraham, mocking. And that's the same word. It's sahach. And that is, you know, what do we do with that word? We don't really know what to do with that. Is he making fun of Isaac? Are they playing? It's translated in lots of different ways, and we just don't know. We don't know what's going on. I've read all kinds of commentaries. One commentary says maybe he was abusing him, but we don't know. But whatever's going on in 21 verse 9, it's not going to be good for Hagar, and Sarah is not going to be happy. So here's verse 10. Wherefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. And God said to Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad and because of thy bondwoman. And all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also out of the son of this bondwoman will I make a great nation, because he is thy seed. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, and the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. I want to draw your attention to that word child in verse 14. In both the Greek translation, the Septuagint from the 3rd century, and the Hebrew text, that's the word that's being used. This is a child. That's going to be important. We're going to come back to that. So she wanders, verse 15, the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. So she's all out of water, she's out of food, and she's going to die. And she went and she sat down over against him a good way off, as it were a bow shot, and she said, let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him and lifted up her voice and wept. So she doesn't even want to look at the child. I can't even lift up my head. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, what aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, hold him in thine hand, and I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. And then we go back to another story in chapter 21 with verse 22. From verse 22 to the end of the chapter, there's this strife between Abimelech and Abraham, and it's about water, and we'll get to that in a minute. But before we go on, a couple things. Notice that God comes to Hagar when the water's spent in the bottle. There's so much to talk about here. One of the things I want to talk about is just this idea that Hagar, who's an outsider from the author's perspective of the Bible, God knows who she is. So that's really tying us back into Genesis 19. Another fascinating thing I find is that he speaks to her when the water is spent in the bottle, when she's all out, when she's completely tapped out, God comes to her. Now, I don't want to be dogmatic about this. I certainly don't think this is all the time. But I think there's something in the scriptures about this idea that God comes to us or in periods of our lives when it looks like things are just not going to work out. One of my favorite stories that really illustrates this idea that God comes, but it's usually not when we want, but after our struggle and toil, is in the sixth chapter of both Mark and John. So in chapter 6 of John, it's the bread of life sermon, and that's kind of the end of John 6. The front part of John 6 is the feeding of the multitude. Right in the middle of that narrative, in verses 16 through 21, is the story of Jesus walking on the sea. And Mark and John are going to give different approaches. So you can pick this up and read it in Mark 6, 45 through 50 and John 6, 16 through 21. But the idea is this, that they're supposed to get across. The disciples are supposed to get across the Sea of Galilee, and they're out there rowing. And to kind of put in your mind's eye kind of, you know, what are we even talking about as far as distances? Think like Bear Lake, if you've been to Bear Lake. The measurements of Bear Lake are basically like the Sea of Galilee. And they're trying to get across, and they're rowing, and it's just brutal. It's windy, and it's stormy, and they just can't get across. And it says that they've been toiling all night long, and that it's the fourth watch when the Savior appears. Now, the watches are kind of broken down like this. The first watch at night is from 6 to 9. The second watch is from 9 to midnight. The third is about midnight to 3 in the morning, and the fourth watch was from 3 to 6 in the morning. And it's just fascinating to me that it's the fourth watch, and they've been rowing all night. I can't even imagine rowing till 3 or 4 in the morning, just being so exhausted. So this is from the narrative in Mark. It says, "Straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, while he sent away the people. And when he sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. And when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea. And he," meaning Jesus, "was alone on the land." And then I love this verse where it says, "He saw them toiling and rowing, for the wind was contrary unto them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking upon the sea, and would have passed by them. But when they saw him walking upon the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit, and they cried out. And they all saw him and were troubled, and immediately he talked with them and said to them, 'Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid.'" And I find that fascinating that he saw them. In the Mark narrative, it talks about that he saw them toiling, and yet he didn't come to their aid. And I think about that a lot in my life, and I think about times in my life where I've had to go through really hard things, and yet sometimes you're not delivered right away. Sometimes you have to keep pushing through. So whether you call this the water spent in the bottle principle or the God of the fourth watch, you know, we see this in other places. Another example of this is the 1 Kings 17 narrative, when Elijah comes to the widow of Zarephath and she's literally got enough food to make one cake left. And he's like, "Feed me." And she's like, "I have enough to make one more cake, and I'm going to eat it and I'm going to die." So she's out of food. And it's when she gives him that last morsel that she's preserved. Another example to me that I really like is the message of the first vision. There's a line in there where Joseph says, "At the very moment I was about to sink into despair and abandon myself to destruction, I saw a pillar of light." So I really like that. I really like this story, I guess, because it's about a woman. She's an outsider. God remembers her. And it's about the fourth watch. So I guess one way to package this story is, if you're in that boat, if you think, "Oh my gosh, I'm never going to get married, or am I ever going to finish school, or am I ever going to have children?" You know, everybody goes through times in their life when they think, "Am I ever going to?" And I think that's part of the test of mortality. I know, remember Joseph, when he was in liberty and Liberty Jail, and he was like, how long am I going to be here? Like, tell me when. And sometimes the Lord helps and he'll give us some clues and hints. And sometimes he just doesn't tell us. And he's just like, "Yeah, it's going to be hard." And he'll strengthen us. And in this narrative, she is saved. And it's good. And it's a beautiful story. Although it's difficult. It's difficult, but it's beautiful. And you're kind of seeing this throughout the book of Genesis. One thing I do want to draw your mind to, this is not maybe as devotional of reading, but I think it's a critical reading of the text to really look at it, is there's an issue here going on with verse 14. So in Genesis 21:14 again, he's called a child, but notice Abraham's giving her bread and he's giving her water, and we're still in 21. And in 21:14 it says that he put the child on her shoulder and sent her away. The Hebrew of Genesis 21 has Abraham literally placing Ishmael on Hagar's shoulder and calling him a child. And this is in the Greek text as well. The narrator presupposes a child small enough to be carried by his mother. But this is important. Since Ishmael was 13 years old before Isaac was ever conceived, if you go back and read Genesis 17, verse 25, and Isaac's weaning, which likely occurred by the time he was about 3, had already taken place, that's Genesis 21, verse 8, Ishmael, by my math, is at least 16 years old in this narrative. In an analysis informed by source criticism, the problem is easily explained, since the present narrative stems from the Elohist, but the chronology is coming from the priestly author. So what does that mean? What I'm saying is that this is a story within a story. So the Elohist author is telling you the story. He way predates P, and he tells you the story. Later, the priestly author is going to put stuff in there, and there's other text woven in here, and a redactor is going to put it together, and the redactor doesn't do the math on this, and the math doesn't line up, because you're not going to take a 16-year-old and throw him on the shoulder of a woman and say, carry this 16-year-old, and you're not going to call him a child. You'll probably call him a man. And so in this text, this is one of those breadcrumbs showing us the readers that, hey, there's stuff going on here. There's multiple layers to this story. So how did the Jews deal with this? Because the Jews were really careful readers of the text. They calculated Ishmael's age, these Jewish sages, they calculated him to be about 27 at this time. So a Midrash that they put together, Midrash is a commentary, they take a different approach. They say this in their Midrash, and this is in Genesis Rabbah. That's a text where they comment on the scriptures. In Genesis Rabbah, they say that Sarah cast the evil eye on Ishmael and made him ill, thus incapable of walking. And so that's kind of their way out of it, where they're like, okay, clearly he's not a little boy. So what do we do with this? Well, Sarah cast the evil eye on him, and so she, meaning Hagar, had to carry him off. So that's Genesis 21 with Hagar and Ishmael and the being cast out, and I'm sorry I don't have an answer for what in the heck do we do with verse 9. There's so many ways to read that verse, and so I don't know, but it's there, and it's clearly getting us to think. But now the rest of Genesis 21 to me is fascinating, and it plays into our motifs about kingship and the hero's journey and chaos. And so if you didn't listen to that podcast, you might want to go back and listen to it. But in essence, when you have conflict and then you have resolution, the end of the resolution is a feast, and there's usually a theophany, some kind of vision, or there's a wedding, there's like a really cool thing happening. If it's a hero movie, right, the bad guys are cast out and the good guys get to sit on their throne, or they get, you know, good publicity, or however you want to work this out. But the rest of Genesis 21 is one of those texts where people could read it and be like, why is this even in here? And I read it and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And it fits into kind of what we've been talking about in the other podcast. So we've kind of set this up. So here it is. Okay, so here's what we've got. A big conflict over water. Verse 25 says that Abraham's going to reprove Abimelech because of the well of water which Abimelech's servants had taken violently away. So they take away his water rights. And then Abimelech says in verse 26, Abimelech says, I wot not what who had done this thing. Neither did thou tell me, neither yet heard I of it, but today. And Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and both of them made a covenant, berith. Now the word for made is karath, and that is cut. And so a better reading of this text is that Abraham and Abimelech are going to cut a covenant. And that is the meaning of the word covenant. This is right out of a great Hebrew lexicon, and this is what it says. A covenant, so called from the idea of cutting, karath, since it was the custom in making solemn covenants to pass between the divided parts of the victims, or the animals in this case, coming right out of Genesis 15:9, deserves attention. Strictly nothing more than eating together or a banquet. since among the Orientals, to eat together is almost the same as to make a covenant of friendship. The Hebrews were accustomed to eating together when entering into a covenant. And in this way, we obtain the explanation of covenant, a covenant of eating or a covenant of salt. It is used of a covenant entered into between nations, between individuals, between friends, and marriage. It involves eating. It involves cutting. Now think about the sacrament. Think about what it means to take the sacrament. We're eating, we're in a group, and it's all tied into this word of covenant. And so in this sense, it's not going to say that they're going to eat, but what I'm saying here is in these verses, Abimelech and Abraham are going to make a covenant of peace, and they're going to eat. That's just kind of like the unwritten part of the text. It's happening outside the text. And so it says that Abraham set 7 ewe lambs by the flock by themselves in verse 28. And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What mean these 7 lambs?" And he said, "These 7 ewe lambs shalt thou take of my hand, that we may be that they may be a witness unto me that I have digged this well." So Abraham's like, "Listen, I dig this well, this Be'er." Wherefore, he called that place Be'er Sheba, or we're just going to say Beersheba, because there they swear both of them. So Beersheba, Be'er Sheba, Sheba is 7, or it means oath, and the other word Be'er is well. So this is literally translated the well of the 7 or the well of the oath. And if you actually look in the footnote 31a, it says the well of the oath or the well of the 7. So the word Sheba is literally 7, but it also means covenant. It can later take on meanings to be perfect. And so the number 7 is a big deal in the Bible. It's a big deal in the New Testament. It's a big deal in the Old Testament. And it's a really big deal in the Book of Mormon. In fact, I want to just draw your mind back to the story of Ammon. If you read a careful reading of Alma 17, he's killing 7 of these guys at a place called the Waters of Cebus. And Cebus to me is a cognate of Sheba. I look at it as the Waters of 7, the Well of the 7. I know there's a lot of commentary on the Waters of Cebus, but I see that there. I see Sheba happening there. And so Ammon's going to take Lamoni to God, to the oath, to the Sheba. He's going to take him to the oath. He's going to take him to the 7. And then later, if you get into the text, the author Mormon's going to tell us that there's going to be 7 huge groups of Lamanites that are going to come and be converted. And there's 7 happening all over the place in the Book of Alma with Mormon's editorial artistry, where he's just going to do all kinds of stuff with 7. So if you guys are interested in that, we can set you up with that stuff. And so we have this well, we have this oath, and they make it. And it says in verse 32, they made a covenant at Beersheba. They made Karath Abarith. They cut a covenant. And Abimelech rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. So this is really cool on a lot of levels. Before I get into the totally cool part of it, I do want to just say this. There's the mentioning of the Philistines there in 32 and also 34. That's an anachronism. The Philistines show up after Abraham's gone. But the author or the editor who is ever putting this together, they know about the Philistines. The Philistines are these sea peoples that come to the Mediterranean, and they come several hundred years after Abraham. And so to him, he's just like, that's who he's hanging out with. He's hanging out with the Philistines, but he's not. It's like I said, it's another one of those breadcrumbs to show you that the Bible's been edited, but may not be that important, but just know that that's there. What I see that's cool here is this. There's a covenant of peace. Abimelech and Abraham once again have peace. There's water. So we're back to this idea of chaos, the fighting of the dragon. There's a conflict over water. It's resolved. And it's resolved by the man of God, Abraham, and it's resolved through covenants. And then we also have water in a good sense. We have the well of the 7, the well of the oath. So we have the eating of the sacrificial animal and the drinking of the water, the drinking of the well of the 7, the eating of the sacrifice. To me, as a Christian, I just see sacrament all over the place. And I also see it's the hero's journey. The hero is, you know, he is overcoming the conflict, and conflict is resolved, and it's done through God. So Abraham is doing some cool stuff, and Genesis 21 is really cool. But really, the heart of this podcast is going to be Genesis 22, and that's the sacrifice of Isaac. And so we get, the very beginning, we get this message that says that God did tempt Abraham. And it's this word nasah, and it means to test. And God's testing him here to see if he'll do what he needs to do. I really like what one commentator said, where he said, God doesn't need to find out about Abraham. He already knows who Abraham is. The story of Genesis 22 is Abraham finding out about Abraham. And I really like that. And so, we know the story. This in Judaism, this is going to be called the Akedah, which just means the binding. It's the only time in the Old Testament where the word Akedah is used, where the word the binding is used. That word shows up in verse 9, where they get to the mount. It says they came to the place which God had told them of. Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son, Akedah, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. This story of the binding totally shows the uncertainty of faith. The idea that we are being tested and our faith will be tested. And Abraham, I believe, fully expects that Isaac is going to die. And I think the author of the story is fully knowing and letting us know that, no, this isn't going to be the death of Isaac. But it's just, it pulls on our emotional heartstrings. So many times in here, in the Hebrew, it's going to talk about Isaac as the only son. Verse 2 says, take now thy son, thine only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I tell thee of. And so from the very beginning, this is God speaking, and he tells him to take him, and he's going to call him his only son. Now, the Greek is going to call him the beloved son, the agapes, but in the Hebrew, he's called the only son. And so in John, we read that, you know, God so loved the world, this is John 3:16, right? That God so loved the world that he gave his only son, his only begotten son. And over again, the narratives of the gospel writers are going to use these ideas of only son and beloved son to say that Jesus is the fulfillment of what's happening in the binding in the Genesis 22 narrative. And so here he takes him. And then he says in verse 3 that he takes a couple of guys with him, a couple servants. And then verse 4 says that the third day after traveling, the third day they see the place afar off, this place called Moriah. And Abraham takes the wood in verse 6, and he lays it upon Isaac, his son, and he took the fire, and they went, both of them, together. So they leave the servants, and they go to the mountain. Now, there's a lot of things happening here that I want to draw your attention to. One of them is, historically and through tradition, the idea that Moriah is the Temple Mount. Moriah is, according to one author, we've got 2 Chronicles 3:1, where it says, Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem in Mount Moriah, where the Lord appeared unto David his father, in the place that David had prepared the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So the author of Chronicles is tying the tradition of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, and he's tying it to the Temple Mount. It's also tied to this idea of vision or seeing, and it's also an anagram for the phrase, the mountains. If you look in verse 2, it says, get to the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains. And so there's a lot of layers to this and punning going on, but I want to draw your attention to that idea that Moriah, at the heart of it, you get this word Ra'ah in Moriah, and it literally means to see or to provide. And so Moriah is going to be a pun. It's going to be this idea that Moriah is the land of vision. It's the place of the seeing or the place of providing. And so that's kind of the message of Genesis 22. Abraham does the work of God. He does what God tells him to do. And because of it, he has a vision and God provides. And so the name or the word Moriah is literally rooted into this whole story. God provides. And Abraham even says that. If you look at verse 8, it says, Abraham said, when they're going up the mountain, and Isaac says, Dad, where's the sacrifice? Like, I get that we're going up the mountain, we're going to sacrifice to God, but where is it? In verse 8, Abraham says, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for the burnt offering. And that word provide, ra'ah, right there in the text, right there in chapter 22, verse 8, is the root, the heart of this Moriah. It's what's happening here. And I think in a big picture, this is what God will do for us. God essentially says, do you trust me? Do you trust me enough to do something that maybe doesn't make sense? And if you do, then we'll do great things. And you'll see things that you didn't see before. Now, there's a lot of other ways to read the text. Paul's going to take it in the 11th chapter, if you remember Paul's narrative in Hebrews 11. In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, where he basically, it's the who's who chapter of all the people of great faith. And in Paul's narrative, he says that Abraham had so much faith that he was totally willing to kill Isaac. He was totally willing because he knew that God had the power to resurrect him, to raise him from the dead. And that's Paul's take. Paul basically gets into the head of Abraham and says, no, this was going to happen. This was a thing. And don't mince words. I'm not going to mince words with you like he's doing this. Notice what it says. This is Paul in verse 17. He says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tried or when he was tempted or tested, he offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And then this is Paul's midrash. He says, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. And so to Paul, and that's chapter 11 of Hebrews, to the author of Hebrews 11, he's basically saying, look, this was going to happen. And so he's just about to do it. And we read in verse 11 of Genesis 22, so we're back in the Genesis narrative, the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here am I. And he said, lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything to him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou shalt has not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked and beheld behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. A couple things in there. You have the to this day part. So that tells you that's another one of those breadcrumbs where the narrator is telling you who they are. But that phrase, the name that it shall be called in verse 14, if you look in your footnote, it even says there, it says, in a mount the Lord shall be made manifest or seen. And then also verse 14, the Lord will see or provide. So that literally is what Moriah means, but it's also the name of the mountain. So God will see, God will provide, but also we will see. And I also like to say that through our sacrifice to God, we can provide as we are participants in this idea of coming to God and who he is. Now, as a Christian reader of the Old Testament, I can't read this and not see Jesus all over the place. And so the idea that it's his only son, that all the seed of the earth will be blessed, that's Jesus. He literally is the Messiah. He's everything that the New Testament authors say that he is. And it's only in and through him that we're saved. And the Book of Mormon authors, they're consistently saying this message, right? It's only in his name. There's no other name, nor other means, nor other way whereby salvation may come, only in and through the blood of Christ. And so I like that. I also like that from a typological standpoint, Mount Moriah is very close to Golgotha. And so the idea of where the sacrifice takes place of the only begotten son, we see that. We also can see in this narrative the emotion of the father. Abraham's name, which means exalted father of many nations, is to sacrifice his son. And so we get a glimpse of the gut-wrenching emotion that Heavenly Father must have gone through to see his son go through this. And that's very difficult to convey. And I don't know how to say it in a podcast other than just to bear my testimony that I have faith in this, and it's just overwhelming. It's awe-inspiring to think about what Heavenly Father must have felt as he saw what had to happen on our behalf. This quote by John Taylor really tries to bring home what I'm trying to say. John Taylor, speaking of Jesus, he said, "His suffering affected universal nature, world upon world, eternal things. Hang on thy anguish, O King of Kings. When he gave up the ghost, the solid rocks were riven, the foundations of the earth trembled, and all material things were convulsed with the throes of seeming dissolution. Thus, such was the torturing pressure of this intense, this indescribable agony, that it burst forth beyond the confines of his body, convulsed all nature, and spread through all space." That's John Taylor. That's in his book, Mediation and the Atonement, page 151. And I like that. It just really speaks to me. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is not the savior of the world. He's the savior of the cosmos. That's the word that's used in the Greek, cosmos. And the author clearly could have used other words for earth, but he used cosmos. In the Gospel of John, it's translated as world, but it literally means the order of the cosmos, anything that has order. And so the whole universe, from the standpoint of the Gospel of John, it's all blessed because of Jesus. And so if you look at this, right after the ram sacrifice, the angel of the Lord calls Abraham a second time. And this is what it says, verse 16, chapter 22 of Genesis. "By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies." So a couple things. We've got the angel of the Lord in verse 15 in the text, but then we have actually the Lord speaking. So that distinction is kind of blended in a lot of these passages. But I want to draw your attention to the promise. So you're going to have lots of seed. You're going to possess land, the gate of your enemies. That's going to have reference to a couple of things. It's going to have a reference to Egypt, but more specifically, after they come out of Egypt, to the land of Canaan. And so we see this as future pacing. What's going to happen to the Israelites? We don't even have the house of Israel yet, but this is all foreshadowing. "And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to the young men, and they rose up, and they went to Beersheba, the well of the seven. And he dwelt there at the well of the seven, Beersheba. "And it came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, Behold, Milcah, she has borne children unto thy brother Nahor." And then we get into this narrative of, what are we going to do for my son Isaac? And so the rest of the chapter is talking about, we've got to go get Rebekah. We've got to go get a wife for my son. But I want to just end with this idea that from this standpoint, you know, I can't read Genesis 22. I can't read Genesis 22 without seeing Jesus in there. I can't. Like, it's just there. I mean, Isaac is this willing sacrifice. He clearly is old enough to be bound. He's old enough to resist his father, and he doesn't. Abraham's got to be super old. And so this also shows a willingness on his part. From a Jewish perspective, as elsewhere in Genesis, these actions foreshadow the later history of Israel. The Israelites, they too were called to go on a three-day journey to worship God upon a mountain. There the Lord appeared to them and gave them the law and promised blessing to those who kept it. Every father in Israel was expected to dedicate his firstborn son to the Lord and redeem him by offering a sacrifice. So in Exodus, this redemption of the firstborn recalls the Passover in which the firstborn sons of Israel were spared judgment. It may be that Genesis itself is just comparing Isaac's rescue to that of sparing Israel's firstborn sons in the Exodus, and the ram Abraham offered, it could be compared to the Passover lamb. In later Jewish tradition, like the Book of Jubilees, which is another book of Genesis, it's a book of Genesis that doesn't make it into the Bible. It's Second Temple literature, like we talked about before. A connection is made between the Passover and the sacrifice of Isaac. The verb tested also invites comparison with the Exodus experience, for it is most frequently occurring in connection with Israel's wilderness wanderings, either referring to God testing them or to Israel's testing God. So in Deuteronomy, Israel tests God, and in Exodus, God tests Israel. So I find these connections just fascinating, that this is foreshadowing the Israelites. It's foreshadowing their experience. Even the sacrifice of Isaac, to many Jewish commentators, is foreshadowing the temple sacrifices. In the 28th chapter, verse 22, Genesis 28:22, Jacob's going to promise to tithe, and that's going to foreshadow later national practice of the tithing of the Israelites, and even today we do this. So Abraham's sacrifice of the ram could be a foreshadowing or an anticipation of the burnt offering of the lamb every morning and every evening in the temple. And then remember, 2 Chronicles 3:1 is going to basically say, hey, Moriah is the temple mount. And so in post-biblical Judaism, it was sometimes affirmed that the temple sacrifices were accepted because of the merits of Isaac, because he was so willing to be an obedient sacrifice. His obedience was recalled each time an animal was sacrificed, so that the atoning value of the sacrifice really depended on Isaac's willingness to suffer, not the death of the animal. So that's the Jewish perspective. They tied the death of these animals to Isaac's willingness to die. I find that fascinating as a Christian, because I can't take the sacrament and not think about the son's willingness to die. And in fact, I don't look at any offering I do or any sacrifice I do as something that's redemptive because of what I do, but because of Jesus's willingness. It's because of Jesus's willingness to do what he did that the sacrifices and the things that we do that are tied to religion, those things are efficacious because of his willingness. And so that ties us back into King Benjamin's speech, where he says, listen, this is all for nothing if Jesus doesn't do what he does. He says, you know, if you were to do all these good things, you're yet unprofitable servants. It's only through Jesus that we're saved, and he is what makes it efficacious. And so whether you read this text, Genesis 22, as a Jew, whether you read it as a Christian, whether you read it as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a Christian with a leaning and an understanding of a restoration, it's a beautiful text on any, you know, in any way. And we can also see the gospel writers taking Genesis 22 and using it as a lens to teach about Jesus, especially with this idea of only son, only beloved son, because you get both of those layers. You get the beloved out of the Greek, and then you get the only right out of the Hebrew there. And so that's Genesis 22. I mean, there's some great stuff there. It's such a beautiful chapter. Okay, so we're going to end with just Genesis 23. We're not going to get to 24 in this podcast. We're just going to go to 23. And all I want to say about 23 is this. This is really testing Abraham's faith. He's promised this land, and his wife dies. It says in verse 1 of chapter 23 that she's 127, and then she's going to die. She dies in Hebron in verse 2. And Abraham stands up, and he speaks to the sons of Heth. And he basically bargains with the sons of Heth, the people that are the indigenous people of this land that own it. And he bargains for the price to put his wife in the grave. And it's such a sad chapter, and it's such a sad story. Verse 17 says, in the field of Ephraim, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field, that were in all the borders round about, were made sure, and Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth, before all that went in at the gate of the city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave. Verse 20, and the field and the cave that is therein was made sure unto Abraham for a possession of a burying place by the sons of Heth. The buying price is in verse 16, 400 shekels of silver. And so this is a very sad story. It ends with Abraham purchasing a land for him to bury his wife. He doesn't have the land at the end of 23, but he's steadfast. He just keeps going. He keeps pressing forward. And he buries her in this cave. And even though he doesn't possess the land, like I said, he continually has faith. To me, Genesis 23 really unlocks what Hebrews 11 is saying. Look in Hebrews 11, verse 13. It reads, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, they were persuaded of them and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city." I think what Hebrews 11, 13 through 16 is trying to say is this. This is part of the religious experience. We have faith, and even if the promises aren't fulfilled in this life, we see them afar off. We see in verse 15 that we might have the opportunity to return to our heavenly home. There's a heavenly city. God's prepared it. Verse 16 tells us this, that God is not ashamed to be called our God, but we, Romans 1:16, should not be ashamed to have him as our God. Even though we're in the midst of this chaos of this earth, there is a heavenly home. I remember years ago, I was having a really bad time, a really rough experience, and things weren't working out in my life. And I had a friend share this talk with me by Elder Holland. And the talk was given quite a while ago. I think it was given in like 1999. And it's by Elder Holland called "A High Priest of Good Things to Come." And in this talk, so it's 20 years ago, but in this talk, he just talks about how things were really difficult for him and his wife financially when they were young. And he says, if I could go back and tell that young man about what my life is like now, I would totally tell him it's going to work out. Things are going to be okay. And I thought about that a lot in my life as I've gone through things. And I thought, I wonder what the future Mike would tell the Mike today. And I love this line. It's at the end of his talk. And you kind of got to read the talk. It's just so good. So I'll link it in the notes. But he says, in my mind's eye, just for an instant, I thought perhaps I saw on the side of the road an old car with a devoted young wife and two little children making the best of a bad situation. Just ahead of them, I imagined that I saw a young fellow walking towards Canaraville. It's this town in southern Utah where his car broke down when he was a young man. He says, with plenty of distance still ahead of him, his shoulders seemed to be slumping a little, the weight of his young father's fear evident in his pace. In the scriptural phrase, his hands did seem to hang down. In that imaginary instant, I couldn't help calling out to him, "Don't give up, boy. Don't you quit. You keep walking. You keep trying. There is help and happiness ahead, and a lot of it. 30 years of it now and still counting. Keep your chin up. It'll be all right in the end. Trust God and believe in good things to come." That talk meant so much to me. One of the reasons why it meant a lot to me is I actually did break down right where Elder Holland broke down, right around Canaraville one time when I was with my wife. And I remember just thinking, this is just so hard. I'm not a mechanic. I can't fix this car. Life is just so rough. And I just remember thinking a lot of the things that he talks about in that talk. And he says, you know what? If I could see the future, the future self would go back and tell the person of the past, hey, don't give up, don't quit. And I kind of see this as I read the story. It's kind of a rough ending of our podcast of Genesis 23, where Abraham doesn't have the land. He doesn't have the promises. His son's not even married. And then his wife dies and he can't even bury her. He has to go and beg for a price to put his wife in a tomb. And so it's like I said, it's a rough ending to the text. But one of the messages of the Bible is that God is going to make his promises sure. And that's also one of the messages of the Book of Mormon as well, is that God has not forgotten the promises that he's made. And so with that, I leave my testimony with you that even though times are difficult, the Lord has not forgotten us. He's not forgotten you. He's not forgotten me or Hagar or Ishmael or Abraham, Isaac, or Sarah. And with that, I leave you with my testimony in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.